Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The wildfires in Northern and Southern California this month are a grisly foreshadowing of a world in the fiery grip of climate chaos. It's apparent, unless you're a climate denier, that climate change is upon us and that fire seasons without end are a stark indication of how much human activity and fossil fuels have intensified wildfire regimes, as well as catastrophic weather events. Today we talk with fire and forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, about what we need to be learning from California's escalating problems with destructive fires, driven by a warming, drying climate and a massive expansion of housing in what's called the wildland-urban interface. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, thanks, Barbara. It seems like we've been talking about this subject for quite some time. Always great, good to be on your show.
Yes, well, actually, it's very interesting. I was thinking the other day, or actually I was thinking a couple weeks ago, when we had talked about doing this show back in September and we had to reschedule. And at that time, you wrote to me, well, we probably shouldn't just talk about the wildfire season because it'll be over. We'll talk about more general things. And then when the fires started in California, it jumped into my head, well, this show is going to be more relevant than ever. But what does it say to you that we are doing a show in the fire season and now it's the very end of November?
Absolutely. It seems like, at least in some parts of the West, the fire season is becoming year-long. And actually, in the Rogue Valley, where I live in Southwest Oregon, I stepped off the plane last week, and the first reaction I had was the smoke that was in the valley coming in from the fires that unfortunately devastated the town of Paradise Valley. And I've never seen anything like that in the 20-plus years that I've been living in that part of the country.
And you're pretty familiar with smoke. I know that you got a lot of smoke this summer. You've been getting a lot of smoke for the last few summers, to the point where the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland is reconsidering their outdoor season in the summer.
Yeah, and I think that the bottom line on this, Barbara, is that we're dealing with the face of climate change, which is not an environmental problem. This is a problem of global magnitude that's affecting us at the local level, that's having economic and social disruption problems in addition to all the ecological havoc that it's wreaking.
Well, it seems that the conversation nationally and in the media about the fires that have erupted in California this fall, and as well as the 600 fires that were burning in British Columbia over the summer, there's starting to be talk about that this is an impact of climate change. We're starting to see climate change, that these fires are more intensive and more frequent and in different places, a wider range of places than they used to be because of climate change. There's another word that's popping into the common lexicon now, and that's the wildland-urban interface. I even heard Bill Maher speak about it the other day, though he didn't have it quite accurate about what he was talking about. But what does it mean? Well, first of all, let's talk about what the wildland-urban interface is, and why do you think the media is kind of finally getting a handle on that this is part of the problem about just why we're having more intensive wildfires, but why they're being so much more destructive to human life and property?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that there's no place on this planet that we can run from climate change. I'm in Florida now, and we're seeing more intense hurricanes in this part of the world. I traveled to Alaska for a lot of my conservation work, and we're seeing Native Alaskan villages being displaced by the permafrost melting. In the West, it's forest fires. And so this is happening all over the planet, and it requires local to global solutions. And in the case of the wildland-urban interface, you know, that term itself needs to be modified to deal with what we now call the home ignition zone. And this is the area immediately around the homes that are burning in these fires. And it's real interesting, a lot of the fires that we're seeing today, the homes are burnt to ashes, and the surrounding trees have not been burned by the fire. And this is the result of the fire sending out firebrand, these embers that then land on a roof that hasn't been built for fire resistance, or in somebody's attic vent that hasn't been screened. And so you get structure to structure to structure ignition. So really, we need to kind of rethink what we mean by the wildland-urban interface, both from the standpoint of getting back into land zoning so we're not building in these unsafe places, and then the places that we already have structures, we've got to do a better job of making them fire resistant, because the structures themselves are burning and not the trees around those structures in many of these cases.
Well, you sent me a bunch of interesting articles this morning that I read over breakfast, and I want to kind of touch on the different themes. The first one I want to talk about is what you were just talking about a bit, is about this issue with how much more development has happened in what's called the wildland-urban interface now than, let's say, there was in the 60s or the early 70s. And there's an example of that. And actually, when Sonoma County and Napa County were burning at the end of last summer, early fall, there were a few articles about, including one that you sent me, about there was a massive fire in Sonoma County in wine country in 1964, before it was wine country. And it compared the difference in the disasters, the disastrous effects of that fire and the fire that happened last summer. And a lot of it had to do with there wasn't anybody living in what's called the wildland urban interface then. So I want to talk about that kind of development, and what's really inspired it.
Yeah, you know, I think a couple of things. First of all, a lot of those towns were built during what we call a climate anomaly. This was the middle of the 20th century when there was a cool down in the global climate for a period of about 3 or 4 decades. At that time, we saw the advent of mechanical fire suppression on a scale never before witnessed. This is post-World War II. And so fire suppression was very effective at a time when we were building homes in fire unsafe areas. So, you know, I think the public was got this false sense of security that we could build in these places and not worry about it because the Forest Service would always suppress the fires. Now let's fast forward and look from the 1980s forward, where you've got this sprawl that's happened in these unsafe areas. Now the climate has shifted into a global warming period where fire suppression is becoming less and less effective. Even though we throw more and more dollars at fire suppression, more acres are burning and more homes with them. And so I think it's a combination of poor development strategies, the lack of zoning, building in the wrong places, and now we've got the elephant in the room, so to speak, you know, climate change, which has shifted the whole game on questioning where we build now in Western communities.
Well, I was thinking about one of Trump's kind of ignorant statements related to the fire, where he talked about it's a problem of bad forest management. Basically, you have to get in there and you have to cut down more trees. And yet I saw an image of a neighborhood in Paradise, California that had just burnt to a crisp. And there were two things that stood out. One you just mentioned, the trees were standing, the houses were burnt. But the other thing that really struck me is this was an aerial photograph. And the way that Paradise had been described, and I think the way that Trump thought of it, was like it was like this deep forest with these houses kind of stuck in the middle of trees in a very rustic setting. Well, this picture that I saw was not rustic at all. It was a suburban cul-de-sac. Actually, it was several suburban cul-de-sacs. So that the kind of development that's going on in the wildland urban interface is actually suburban development. It's not rural development like what we know in Oregon, people who live in the woods here. And it actually made me think about the fires in Colorado Springs, outside of Colorado Springs, a number of years ago. And I remember seeing photographs of the neighborhoods that burnt there and thinking I had been in Colorado Springs maybe 10 years earlier, and there was nothing built there. That was just all chaparral and, you know, very dry mountain sites. And suddenly it's all become suburban development. So that leads to another question about land use planning and how has land use planning in some ways shaped where fires burn human development and where they don't burn? And how can we use land use planning and regulations in a stronger way to maybe prevent people from continuing to build in fire prone areas?
Yeah. And, you know, just an interesting point about our president. You know, he said a number of times that all we need to do is log and rake the forest and everything will be fine. You know, and that's furthest from the truth. And it's both an issue of development and, to an extent, how we have poorly managed the forest over time. And I'll comment on that in a minute. But with regards to development, you know, because we live in the West, we've had this attitude of decades of don't tell me what to do with my private property and don't tell me what to do with development. because that's, you know, what is the driver of jobs and regional economies. But at the same time, that's led to the sprawl issues that we have today, with a lot of county governments opposing, you know, land zoning, and, you know, it's hard to get land zoning ordinances passed in the West. I think hopefully that will change as people start to realize what's happening, and that insurance companies have already started to say, hey, if you don't get your home prepared for defensible space, you know, with the methods that reduce the likelihood of a home going up in a forest fire, we're not going to insure you. And so I think we're seeing more and more of that happening today. And there are ways that we can deal with the existing development that lowers fire risks. For instance, screening off the vents so that embers don't go into a house attic, building with a fire-resistant roofing material, and that wood shakes. Clearing the vegetation within about a 100-foot radius around the home. And, you know, those preventative mechanisms, and maybe putting some sprinklers on the roof, would do a lot to preventing those home-to-home ignitions. Anything that happens outside that 100-foot radius of home safety is not going to influence that home. So if we log in the backcountry, that does nothing to change the odds of a home burning up in a fire, particularly one that isn't built for fire resistance.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the regulation bit and about zoning, because yeah, you live in Oregon, even though you're in Florida right now, which has some very interesting land use issues that we won't get into today.
Yeah.
But in Oregon, we have had a very strong statewide land use planning for 45 years now. And I think it shows, the benefits show when we have fires, because there's been many big fires down your way in Southern Oregon, and very few structures, even the Biscuit Fire. And I guess there was another one as big as the Biscuit Fire last year, the Checo Fire. And I don't recall there being very many homes burnt up in those fires. And then last summer we had the Eagle Creek Fire here, and it came within 15 miles of Portland, but no structures except for one unused building were burned, and certainly no houses in the Portland metro area were burned. So what makes Oregon unique? I mean, do you see that our land use planning that we've had in place for so long is really saving lives and saving homes?
I think so. And I also think a lot of these big fires are burning in pretty remote places. The Checo Fire was in the South Kalmiopsis area, which is, you know, among some of the most wild parts left in the lower 48. You know, these are the last places you want to go and build homes, and that's a good thing, right? And so, you know, having tighter zoning laws and limiting sprawl is definitely part of the solution, along with dealing with fire-resisting materials on existing structures. If we do those two things, we'll go a long way to reducing the kinds of unfortunate, tragic losses that we're seeing in cities like Redding and in Paradise Valley and in Southern California, where, you know, hundreds of lives have been lost and thousands of structures. You know, we have an opportunity now to turn that tragic around and say, okay, we're gonna start building with smart, fire-resistant structures, and maybe we won't put those homes back in the same places that burned previously at least once, if not twice, in forest fires. Maybe that's not the smartest place to be doing our development. And maybe not only states like California can learn from that, but states like Oregon can improve their land zoning so that we don't get into the situation that we've seen in California.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with fire and forest ecologist Dominic Dallasala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland, about what we need to be learning from California's escalating problems with destructive and seemingly year-round wildfires. Well, I'm thinking, as you're talking about not having people rebuild in places like Paradise, that the same thing was said about New Orleans, that why are people building in flood zones? Why, you know, particularly the lower ninth ward, and that shouldn't rebuild in the flood zones. And then I spent some time in New Orleans and understood why people wanted to rebuild in the lower nine. And I have mixed feelings about that whole thing, because I understand the culture of New Orleans and how some of the movement to rebuild in only specific neighborhoods, mainly more upper middle class neighborhoods, was a way of driving more poor people and people of color out of the city. It's a little bit different here in the burning West, but I wonder, how do we help communities like Paradise, which was not a high income community? It's not like Malibu and Topanga, which burned or are still burning in Southern California. It was like a retirement community, many people on fixed incomes, many people living in trailer parks, which were really flammable. How do we work with these people to help them to rebuild or relocate in a place that's a lot safer and makes more sense to live?
That's a great question. And, you know, I'll take first a national view on it, and then I'll zoom in on that. But, you know, from a national perspective, again, I'm on the East Coast today, and I look at the climate change projections here, and most of Southern Florida will be gone by the mid to late portion of the century. Portions of New York, Manhattan Island will be totally flooded by mid to late century. So we're looking at huge displacements of where people live at the middle or end of the century. And this is in the lifetime of our grandkids. It's not, you know, some very distant time in the future. And so in the West, we have to also start looking at what do we do to assist people, particularly minorities and economically disadvantaged folks, which are hit the hardest by climate change, the social and economic disruptions. Again, this is not an environmental problem. It's a problem that spans all our cultural institutions. And so we've got to reach out, help the minorities and economically disadvantaged deal with these dislocation issues. And when I look at the Forest Service, for instance, Congress is going to soon start appropriating over $2 billion a year for fire suppression in the wildlands at a time when acres are increasing and the amount of spending is going up. That, to me, is the definition of crazy. You do the same thing over again and expect a different outcome. Perhaps more of that money needs to go into providing some grants and funding sources for people to start retrofitting their homes and moving to other locations. The same thing is going on in Alaska. We need to be helping Alaska villages being displaced by the permafrost melting move to other locations. Otherwise, we're going to be seeing mass migrations of people as a result of these changes in our climate. And again, talking about where we started, this is going to affect everyone on the planet. And it really depends on where you live, the kind of impacts you're going to see.
Well, I just had this image as you're talking about what's going on at the border between Mexico and the United States at Tijuana yesterday and today, where the border was closed.
Exactly.
I think it was in a few hundred migrants who were protesting the fact that the United States is really dragging its feet and letting people be processed to go, apply for sanctuary. And that the response of the Trump administration is close the border with Mexico and spray a lot of tear gas into Mexico from the U.S. side of the border. And I'm thinking about the denial that's also been coming from the Trump administration and other forces about what's going on with the fires. And I want to talk a little bit about your response to what our wonderful Secretary of Interior, Zinke, said about who is responsible for the fires, as well as Trump's idea that we cut down trees and we rake and we blame the Forest Service.
Yeah, you know, it's easy to point the finger of blame at people, and especially a time when there's tragedy going on. I think what would have been a much more humane response would be for the administration to help these people that have been displaced by the fire, that have lost their homes, that have lost their loved ones. It's really deplorable that instead of helping people, they've chosen to point fingers of blame, including at the wrong places. And in fact, what has happened with forest management over decades is we have taken our fire-resistant forests, native grasslands, native chaparral, and we've shifted them into an exotic engineered landscape. And that landscape now has thousands of acres of firebomb plantations, trees closely packed together so that when a fire comes through, it hits it like kindling. Whereas in the past, it would have been a mix of different forest types and the fires wouldn't have burned like we're seeing today. And the same thing in grasslands and chaparral. We've converted them to flammable cheatgrass fields. When fire comes through, it just spreads rapidly. And that's the worst thing for firefighters. They don't like to see a fire moving quickly. They can't do anything about it. It raises all kinds of safety issues for the firefighters. So we have kind of put that in motion. And it wasn't because of the environmental laws that are preventing people from getting in and managing the forest. It's actually the opposite. But the way we have managed the forest, our history of clear cutting and converting these forests that developed with fire in the landscape to the kinds of situations that we see today, that's because of industrial logging and all other activities that we've put on our forests, our grasslands, and our chaparral systems.
Well, how do you feel being being blamed for the fires as a radical environmentalist by our Secretary of Interior, Zinke?
You know, I pride myself on speaking truth to power, and I think that's what this, you know, having the science backing me on this and having people that work on these issues, like Jack Cohen, the retired Forest Service person who's been working on home ignition for many, many decades, you know, he's saying the same thing. And it's really about doing something about reducing the risk at the home, not in the wildland. That's going to give us more bang for the buck in terms of how we invest limited public resources and dollars in preventing tragic loss of life and property.
So let's talk a bit more about Jack Cohen, because he seems like a really interesting guy, and he was doing this research kind of way back when people were still talking about, well, they still are talking about the 10 a.m. rule for fighting wildland fires.
Yes, and, you know, that's contributed to some of the problems we're facing, too. You know, the forests need to burn. They're born to burn, these dry forests, and they do quite well after a forest fire. In fact, we would not have the beauty and diversity of forests that we have on our public lands today if not for the periodic influence of fire as an architect of nature. And so fire is going to do its thing, regardless of what we try to do. We can't stop it the next day at 10 a.m. We can't stop it even for 2 or 3 months at a time with full suppression forces with these large fires that escape containment, mainly because they are extreme fire weather-driven events. Some of the fires with the Santa Ana winds, for instance, in Southern California, blowing at 90 miles an hour. These are hurricane force winds. We've seen images of this on video. You cannot stop those forest fires. So instead, we need to be putting more resources into building in the right places and building with the right materials.
So what do we do with the homes that are in the wrong places that haven't burned yet?
I think everyone needs to be aware of where they are buying a house. You know, it's the same thing with, well, we shouldn't buy a house in the floodplain. Anybody that has a home has floodplain insurance if you're living in the floodplain. You take a risk. I don't think we have informed people enough about the risk of buying a home or building a home in an area that at some point it's going to burn regardless of what we do. We've seen this over and over again with repeat fire events in the same fire perimeter. And when that happened in the early 1900s, there were no homes there. Now they happen today, and we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of homes in those same footprints. People need to be aware of the dangers and risks of buying and building in those places.
Well, it seems like one of the big challenges with human nature is getting people to understand an accurate picture of risk. I'm currently reading a book called The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, and it's basically talking about how people perceive probability, statistics, risk, and how all the things, all of our intuitive senses that make us make the wrong decision because we really don't understand what risk is. And so one of the things has to do with if you live in a fire-prone area and your house has never burned, then you don't think the chances are very high that it ever will burn until it does burn. And actually, I've seen some articles around the California fires that quote people as kind of saying that. So how do we get people to understand that, yes, just because your house hasn't burnt yet doesn't mean that you don't live in a really high-risk area, and how do we get people to learn from other people's experience what their own risk is?
You know, it has to be neighborhood to neighborhood. And you could do everything by the book, like Jack Cohen says, to reduce your risk of a home ignition in a fire. But if your neighbor has it and that home burns in a fire, it could still go structure to structure. So it has to be a community neighborhood thing. And in the book that Chet Hansen and I worked on, subtitled Nature's Phoenix, we talk about planning for fireshed. You know, everybody knows what a watershed is, and we've been planning on watershed scales for many, many years now. We need to start thinking about firesheds. These are neighborhoods that live in the same area with similar fire risks, and getting together to plan how they're going to make their existing homes fire safe. There are grants that can be applied for funding to do this. There are organizations that do this for a living, that go around working with communities to make their communities fire safe. So there's funding out there. Unfortunately, it's not nearly as much as it needs to be, which comes back to the earlier discussion about, are we putting billions of dollars of congressional appropriated funds in the right funding pot? I argue that we're putting far too much suppression dollars in, and we should be putting more money in helping people get ready for forest fires, building with safe materials, and doing something about moving people out of harm's way.
Well, another thing that struck me as, particularly looking at those pictures of the trees that are still standing unburned with burnt to the crisp buildings around them in Paradise, California, that there's the trees are, some trees are more fire resistant than others. And I had read an article the other day about how in British Columbia, there's actually provincial law that requires that that they basically cut down broadleaf trees because they get in the way of better, you know, higher producing for timber purposes conifer trees. But in fact, the broadleaf trees are much more fire resistant. And so they're in the process of turning all of British Columbia's fire resistant forests into fire prone tinderboxes.
Yeah, that's really problematic. I know that's similar in my neck of the woods down in southern Oregon. The hardwoods seem to do better in fires than the conifers. But I think, you know, what people can be doing is pruning the lower branches on their surrounding trees, making sure they have no branches touching their structures, their roof, and just going around and getting rid of flammable shrubs like juniper, for instance. That's the worst shrub you can have near a home because it'll just ignite like kerosene when a fire comes through. So, you know, people start asking questions about not only are you planting with deer-resistant shrubs, but are you planting with fire-resistant materials around your house?
And definitely don't plant any eucalyptus.
Yeah, right.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with fire and forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. We're talking about what we need to be learning from California's escalating problems with destructive and seemingly year-round fires. So I want to get back to this year-round fire thing. And this is the first year I've ever experienced watching fires burn in California in late November. I'm very familiar with the fire season that has, it used to start in August and go maybe to the end of September, and lately it started in May and gone till the end of October. But what do you think is, those two parts, like what do you think is causing the extension? Do you see that we may be actually at some point having year-round fires? And how do we cope with this change? And what ways do we make ourselves more resilient to the fact that fire season is becoming maybe half or more than half the year?
Well, I know you've covered this on some of your other shows, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its recent findings, along with the scientists' second warning to humanity, signed by thousands of scientists, saying, you know, the window of opportunity is quickly closing. The IPCC gives us, what, 12 years before we are in runaway climate change, and the warning to humanity from scientists said we had about a decade or so. So we're really at a crucial time period that we have got to turn things around with, as IPC says, historic and unprecedented change. And we need a moonshot right now in terms of transforming our energy usage to renewable, clean energy sources and reduced waste. And we've got to store more carbon in ecosystems by protecting forests from logging rather than increasing logging. Some of the forests in our region, along the coast, for instance, old growth forests, rainforests, store vast amounts of atmospheric carbon. They're like a big sponge of carbon, soaking it up from the atmosphere. They are part of the solution to the carbon pollution that we're putting in the atmosphere. And in order to get to a rational fire policy, we have got to solve for climate change. And we've got to get off of fossil fuels and keep more carbon in the forests.
Well, I'm just thinking about this young woman I heard speak at a hearing for the supplemental environmental impact statement that's been redone for the Tacoma LNG facility, which is very controversial. And there were two high school students. Well, one was a high school student, one was a middle school student who spoke very eloquently. And the 12-year-old actually talked about how she's part of this youth group that she helped start that plants, they're trying to plant 1 billion trees around the world. And I wonder, do you think that this is an effort that actually would become a really substantial carbon sink and could help to stave off runaway climate change?
I think it could be part of the solution, and I would make sure that we're planting with native plants in the right places. I think we call this afforestation, so going into like an agricultural field that isn't being used for crops anymore, you could be doing that to absorb more carbon. But I think we also have to hold on to the forests that we already have. The tropics, the boreal, the coastal temperate rainforest, all are storing massive amounts of carbon. And the more we cut those forests down, the quicker the carbon goes up into the atmosphere. And right now, I think the latest findings were deforestation and forest degradation contributes more greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere than the entire world's transportation system. This is an area that we could have natural climate solutions be a big part of how we get to a safe climate, in addition to replanting and in addition to, really reducing our wasteful consumption levels.
Well, I'm thinking about just the deforestation that I've seen in my own lifetime. I mean, when I came to Oregon, I think that the figure was that there was only 15% of the old growth forest left in the Northwest. And it sounded like a really small amount, because I was astonished to come here and see any old growth forest at all, having grown up in the East Coast. But but I could see the clear cutting, too. And it was just kind of starting in the early 70s on an industrial scale that hadn't really happened before. Well, I'm not sure what the figure is now. Is it somewhere between 3 and 5% of the old growth is left, if that much? So my question is, how do we, when we've been just cutting and cutting and destroying it over the last 45, 50 years, what do we do to not just stop the cutting, but to start to turn around the whole process?
Yeah, fortunately, we have more old growth than what you may think. And based on some of the latest inventories, we've got about 15 to 20% left.
Oh, so it came back.
I like to look at the glass as half full, if you will. And so, we need to do everything possible to make sure that we're not cutting those older forests down. So that's number one. And then number two, I think that Oregon in particular needs to do forestry reforms. We have some of the most abysmal forestry practices in the three-state area compared to Washington and California. The amount of clear cutting, the lack of stream buffers, the cutting on steep slopes, which has caused all kinds of erosion problems and even loss of homes and lives in some situations. So we've got to do more about our forestry practices so that they are fire and climate safe. We have to look at incentives for private landowners so that they can leave the trees on the landscape for longer periods of time. And some of Bev Law's work at Oregon State University and Mark Harmon and others, they've shown that if we can extend the what's called the timber harvest rotation rate from about every 35 years, the forests get cut down in an individual location, to doubling that to 70 or 80 years, we will save massive amounts of carbon in the forests that are out there on the landscape for a longer period of time. So now we've got to look for the incentives to allow that to play out.
Well, I'm thinking also one of the contradictions that we're faced, and one of the ways to save forests is to densify cities, which we've been seeing a lot here in the Northwest, intensely with Seattle and Vancouver, and starting in a big way now with Portland. And one of the things that happens when you have more density built in the city, you start cutting down the trees, which is what's happening in Portland. There was a lot around the corner from my house that had an old house on it that was a antique store, and then it was a vacant lot next door, and there were a whole bunch of nicely big trees that were probably 100 years old. They're all cut down. They're now putting up a four-story mixed-use building on the whole lot. So how do we balance, because it seems to me that urban trees are also really important for being a carbon sink and for producing oxygen and for just basically really enhancing the livability of cities. How do we maintain an urban canopy when we're also trying to densify the urban development?
Absolutely. And I think that's an important issue you've hit on. It's a whole urban ecology thing that's going on, a movement around the nation and internationally. And, you know, when I go to places like Washington, D.C., in the summertime, it's brutal there. It gets warmer, I swear, at nighttime, because you got all the heat radiating off of the concrete structures and you got very few trees. We need to have more tree cities. We need to be building with what's called biomimicry. There's a lot of that going on internationally where we mimic the structure of ant mounds, for instance, so that they cool over the building rather than heat over the building. And also doing more with our rooftops. Solar collectors on the roofs, rooftop gardens. I mean, there's a lot that we could be doing. Saving trees in the urban area would allow for more cooling and shading. I mean, what we're talking about here is redesigning our communities, whether we're looking at small areas, rural areas that, you know, we're talking about moving them out of harm's way, or we're talking about big cities and making them more eco-friendly. Hopefully that's what will happen as a result of, you know, a wake-up call that we need to start doing things differently to respond to the challenge of historic, unprecedented changes if we're going to get to a safe climate.
Well, one of the concerns that we have right now is that we have such an unwilling administration in Washington, D.C., and I'm also concerned about the new president of Brazil, who I guess is threatening to cut down the rest of the Amazon rainforest. And how do we balance? I mean, that's like a, it's hard not to feel a lot of despair when we're looking at what could be done if we had better national leadership around the world. So what's your thoughts on how do we counter the forces that are in D.C. right now that are driving us quicker and quicker towards runaway climate change?
Well, I'm excited by the change that took place in November, and there's a lot more discussion about a Green Deal now. The new Green Deal, and hopefully that will get some traction, and we'll start seeing some policy initiatives coming out of the new Congress that will move us into having the kind of discussion and forward movement that has to happen on climate change instead of the continuation of denial. And on the East Coast right now, in parts of the East Coast, they're having a very cold winter, and every time this happens, you get the naysayers out there saying that, see, we told you so, there's no such thing as climate change, rather than having the discussion of, look, this is not even an argument anymore in the scientific community. What we need to do now is we've got to start arguing about the types of policies that need to be put in place to get to a new Green Deal if we're going to have a safe climate in the short period of time that we've been warned about.
Well, getting back to some of the lessons we could be learning from California's fires, I've had conversations with friends whenever there's a major fire that erupts close to a metropolitan area, whether it's in California or whether it was in Fort McMurray, Alberta, a couple of years ago, is like, could it happen here around Portland? And a friend of mine, when I think Santa Rosa was burning last year, saw that Ashland was a possible the next Santa Rosa. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are. Are there communities in Oregon that you think are as endangered as these communities in California that keep starting to burn?
I think so. And I think that getting in front of it now with smart planning is the way to avoid those tragic situations or at least lower the risk significantly. And you mentioned Ashland, which is the town that I work in. There are others like Bend, and just about any place that is in a dry forest setting is going to have this challenge. And I think that the way to deal with it is back to some of Jack Cohn's provisions. You know, let's get to a defensible space and reducing the home ignition probability. I think all those towns that are in that situation need to plan for that, and they need to plan for escape routes, quick ways in and out of the town, ways that are safe for firefighters to get in and out of places so that they're not in harm's way when they're trying to put out a fire burning in somebody's house. You know, we really have got to look at redesigning our urban environment, and there are a lot of great ideas out there about how to do this. We've got the solutions. We just need to start implementing them.
You know, I think about the area around Sisters, Oregon, and I think Camp Sherman, and that's an area that burns every few years. And there's been, and that's probably, my sense, the closest we've come to having situations like are happening more and more in California. Except in, or I don't actually, I can't think of anybody who's died in a forest fire in Oregon in a very long time. So, and I might be wrong about that, but it seems. I'm thinking about the patterns of development in the Bend area, that it's more of the cul-de-sac in the woods kind of development that we see in California and Colorado. I don't see that in Ashland. Ashland's development did jump I-5 a number of years ago, and there's a little bit of a development on the east side of I-5. But
yeah.
It seems that Ashland is still very far from being that kind of place where you have cul-de-sacs in the woods.
I think some homes along the mountainside, you know, you go on one side of the I-5 and you've got big open rangeland and agricultural areas that are not going to burn like you would on the other side of town where you've got homes that are built right into the side of the mountain. I think those are the most fire prone. We actually did a study not too long ago using remote sensing to zoom in on home structures from space. And what we could see was a shocking number of homes built with wood shake roofs. And to me, that's just the recipe for disaster. And we're trying to get the word out to Ashland and other communities that these are the places most vulnerable to fire and least likely that firefighters are going to go in and try to put the fire out if your home was built that way, because they're not going to get in harm's way trying to defend a structure that's indefensible.
And not only that, I mean, the other concern that I was picking up from some of the articles I was reading this morning is that a lot of these places don't have very accessible roads. And so that's another thing where, and maybe that should be a point of regulation and development, that if you are not to build any new roads into the woods, but if an area is not well serviced by roads that you can get easily out, then there should be no building there as well.
Absolutely. We see this a lot again in California. And I should point out that a lot of the fires in California are not in forests. They're in chaparral. And, you know, chaparral is going to burn. It was born to burn. And yet we see people building homes in canyons surrounded by chaparral and grassland vegetation that is just going to race right up the mountainside and right through the structure.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LP FM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with fire and forest ecologist Dominique Della Sala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland. And we're talking about that sort of the thoughts that come on the aftermath of these massive fires that have been burning in California. One of the things that keeps coming to mind as these fires burn, and I remember talking with the person who runs this show up in Seattle, and we were going to do a show about fire. I was going to rerun the show about fire, and it was right when Santa Rosa was burning last year. And we had this discussion about how can you talk about fire being good when these communities are going up in flames. So I just wanted in the last part of the show to talk about that whole transition from fire bad to fire good to what is fire now, and how do we be able to continue to appreciate the beneficial aspects of fire at the same time that we recognize that it has some really catastrophic aspects as well.
You know, everyone needs to feel safe, right? And when there's a danger looming, no one's going to care about what the ecological effects of a fire are. So I think we need to take care of safety and survival first and foremost. And it's really unfortunate that we've got leadership that is taking us in a different direction. So right after this tragic loss in Paradise Valley, the first thing out of Trump's mouth was we got to cut more trees rather than how can we as a nation come together and help these people that have had the worst possible experience happen to their community, their loved ones, and their property? We've got to take care of people first and foremost. If we take care of and solve for safety and survival, get us to a safe climate so that we don't have to worry about these events anymore, then we can appreciate the magnificence of nature, even when a forest fire comes through. And to the untrained eye, it looks catastrophic, but in reality, it's a rebirthing event for the forest. It's hard to celebrate that when you have so much loss and you've got leadership that is really sending out the wrong message.
I'd like to send them into the fire zone and see what they think, actually.
Well, Trump was there. You know, he said all we got to do is rake. rake the leaves and the shrubs.
Interestingly, I read several quotes from residents of Paradise who had voted for Trump who were not very pleased with his response to the fire, and sounds like he has lost their vote in 2020. So,
well, not only did he miscall the name of the town, Paradise, he called it Pleasureville or Pleasure.
Pleasure,
something like that. He didn't even get the town's name right.
It was interesting. I saw the footage of Jerry Brown, like, trying to restrain himself until he said it, yeah. I think, the third time, and it was like, okay, we correct him now. But, I mean, it's worse than an embarrassment. I mean, it shows a real callousness. And I think, I mean, the only upside of this is I do think that it's sort of, this was Trump's Katrina in terms of a way that Bush really blew the quote optics of his approach to and his response to Katrina. And certainly, as bad as Trump has been on every disaster so far that he under his watch, this one, I think, in some ways, he really blew the worst.
He did. And, you know, he's not the only one. We heard the same thing out of Greg Walden when he was touring the Eagle Creek fire. He wanted to immediately, he did, he proposed legislation to go into the wilderness areas, the scenic stretch of the Columbia Gorge, and we need to salvage log and replant the forest. Which, you know, the communities don't want to hear that. What they want to hear is, how are you going to help us deal with the economic impacts, the loss, the psychological damage, the trauma? That's what our government should be doing to help people, not talking about how they're going to push forward their policies that benefit one sector of the economy, the timber industry.
Well, actually, speaking of the gorge, I just kind of wanted to mention, I took my first hike into the burnt part of the gorge last week and did the Herman Creek Trail. And it was very interesting to see it. It's not the most extremely burnt part of the gorge, but I had heard a lot of environmentalists and forest activists talking about how the gorge fire was actually a good fire. It burnt the way it should burn, and it was really actually very beneficial in the long term for the forest. And I'm not sure how I'll feel when I actually hike the Eagle Creek Trail and see how that burned. But at Herman Creek, it was really fascinating to see there were a lot of burned trees. There were very few dead trees. Most of the trees, the old growth trees, were blackened as they always are, but they're very healthy at the top. The understory is still pretty sparse because it's just a year. And I'm sure when I go back next spring, it'll be just abundant with bear grass and huckleberries and just, there's not huckleberries there, but like all the understory that would just, the wildflowers will be just extreme and it'll be showing its rebirth. But what I realized is, in a way, I thought that this trail was more beautiful than it had been before the fire. So I think that that's another thing to keep in mind, that there is a benefit to the fire as devastating as the Eagle Creek fire felt to us here last summer, it probably was very beneficial. And I kept thinking about Greg Walden when I was out there wanting to cut this all down and thinking, you should come here and really see what this fire does.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing about that I've learned from all my years working in both rainforest and dry forest is, you know, nature is that it's on a different clock than we are. And we have to have patience. And I've done a lot of plot samples in many different intensely burned forests. And when you go in immediately, you think, wow, you know, this really wiped out all the trees. What a big change this is. And then when you start looking on the ground, you see all kinds of rebirthing events happening. And some of the plots, we're seeing hundreds of seedlings in an acre of in a plot. And this is in some of the most intense burn areas, in the rim fire, in the Sierra and in many of the fires in the Klamath Mountains. We go into these places that look like they just torched, and we look on the ground and we see seedlings, we see flowering plants, we've got birds, we've got pollinators. It's an alive place if we just give it time. And so going in and logging those areas, thinking that they need our help by cutting down the trees and replanting, when nature is already doing that job for us, I think is the worst possible situation ecologically after a forest fire.
Well, actually, I also appreciated, as I started going through the gorge after the fire last year, and the first thing that's very noticeable is you go past Angel's Rest and you see this rock formation that you never saw before because it was used to be obscured by all these old trees that have all burned. And it made me think about, first I thought, well, I'm never going to see the tree-covered Angel's Rest again because they aren't going to grow back in my lifetime. And then I thought about how it felt watching Mount St. Helens blow its top in 1980. And of course, I knew I was never going to see the beautiful ice cream cone top of Mount St. Helens. It was something different. And maybe it's just that we have to really start to learn to appreciate how nature changes, and we go with the changes. And some of them, as cataclysmic as they might be at the time, in the long run are just a new direction we couldn't have imagined ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, the gorge experienced a huge fire in 1904. That, you know, the time when our grandparents were around and they witnessed that event. And then, you know, the forest that we grew to love in the gorge were the result of that time after the fire event of 1904. And so our kids, if we choose to have them, are going to be looking at a different forest today than they will as adults, or their kids will as adults over time. The forests change, and we need to change with it.
And I guess the other thing that's always reassuring to me is when I walk through old growth and I realize that they're all charred because they've been through many fires. What kind of lesson do you see that those old growth trees have for us?
That's the fire-resistant trees that we've taken out of the forest through logging. And so when the trees get about 80 years or so, and this is the case for ponderosa pine in the dry forest, they develop a natural kind of asbestos, and their bark gets thick enough that they could withstand low to moderate intense burns, whereas the forest plantations that we put in there after we log the forest, it's like kindling, and the fire just cuts right through it and races through it like fires gasoline. And so what we need to do is have bigger trees on the landscape, leaving them out there longer periods of time. Not only is that good for the climate, but it's good for fire safety as well, because these are the trees that were designed by nature to be resistant and resilient to forest fires.
And maybe they can be models for us as human beings to be resistant and resilient as well.
Absolutely. We need to cherish our elderly like we cherish our young.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Dominic, for joining us today. It's always good to talk to you.
You bet.
And have a good trip back from Florida and enjoy the sunshine. I hope it's nice and warm while you are there.
Will do. And thanks for having me on again.
Sure.
Barbara.
And we'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Dominic Dallasala, who's with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll hear from Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey with Columbia Riverkeeper about the latest developments for the world's largest methanol refinery that's proposed for Kalama, Washington. My engineer is Tammy Dean. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Thank you.